Investors Chronicle.
Hello and welcome back to the IC Interviews. I'm Dave Baxter and today I'm joined by Neil Herman. He works as a portfolio manager for Janus Henderson. He works on the Henderson Smaller Companies Investment Trust, the Janus Henderson UK Smaller Companies Fund, and the Janus Henderson UK Alpha Fund, with a long record in both financial services and the small and mid-cap space. Neil should be able to shed some light on navigating the domestic markets at a time which I think we can all agree is marked by heightened uncertainty. So Neil, thanks for joining. How are you doing?
Good, thanks Dave. Thanks for your time this morning. Thanks for inviting me on.
Pleasure. So, you know, you obviously focus on domestic shares. You have a big focus on the kind of small and mid-cap space. But of course, it's natural that all eyes are currently focused on the situation in Ukraine. While the most important element, of course, is humanitarian in nature, fund managers and investors will also be giving a great deal of thought for the consequences for economies and for the markets. So just to kick off, you know, as I said, you're focusing on kind of small and mid-cap UK stocks. What are the main considerations here for you as an investor? What are the important impacts that you think listeners should be bearing in mind?
Yeah, it's always something, isn't it? We had COVID, and then we've now moved on to interest rates and inflation, and clearly now on to Ukraine. Obviously, you said it's a horrible humanitarian disaster, so obviously things are put in context by this. Look, I mean, so from a kind of direct exposure from our perspective, you know, there isn't a huge amount of exposure in our portfolio to directly towards Russia and Ukraine. It's a pretty small market for Europe overall. However, it clearly may have an influence on consumer and corporate confidence. You know, this sort of headline is clearly going to impact potentially how businesses operate and invest and so on consumers. And obviously we know the consequent impacts on where Russia is clearly very strong is obviously the commodity side. So price of oil has clearly spiked and other commodities too. So that's going to lead to inflation and increased costs. So a very difficult time overall, and there will be some short-term impacts. And the obvious things that we've seen sectors like, for example, oil stocks and defense stocks rally and other sectors could even fall away. In terms of, you know, how we're thinking about it, it doesn't really impact our long-term perspective in terms of how we see UK spend more as a, you know, a small mid-cap market. Fundamentally, this will wash through over time, and the long-term prospects remain essentially the same. So we're not really adjusting our portfolio to account for this. It's clearly a short-term, and if anything, providing buying opportunities in certain situations where you don't feel this huge long-term impact. So clearly, yes, you know, a horrendous situation, but in terms of the long-term impact on our portfolio, essentially zero.
And you've alluded to this there, but I mean, what are you doing in terms of, I suppose, kind of not just this crisis, but also we, of course, started the year on a very rocky note with the, you've mentioned concerns about inflation, concerns about monetary tightening, kind of putting a bit of a shock through markets and also through some of the kind of stocks that you prefer to own. Where have you kind of found an opportune time to be kind of topping up and adding to exposures? What kind of sectors?
Yeah, look, I think it's been a, you know, very challenging start to 22, not only because of geopolitical events, but also because the market's focused on the issue of rising inflation and what that means for interest rates and bond yields. And we've seen a significant rotation away from growth stocks into value stocks. And, you know, think about the way we do things at Janus Henderson in our team. We are very much growth investors, but we're going to go up growth at the right price, growth at reasonable price. But essentially, the portfolio looks like a growth portfolio. So we've had a, you know, after what's been a number of very good years, 22 has started. It's been a difficult start to the year in context of that performance, as you've seen that rotation away. Fundamentally, though, that doesn't really change the way we do things. We've employed the same process, philosophy, and strategy since I started at Janus Henderson over 19 years ago. And that isn't going to change overnight because, you know, things have shifted a little bit. I mean, in fact, anything you look at it last year, there was significant rotation between growth and value about eight times in the course of 21. So these things can move in the head in the sixpence in a flash of the eye. So, you know, we are going to remain very true to our underlying philosophy around quality growth companies that will deliver long-term returns through structural long-term growth trends. So I think really what we found this year is a buying opportunity. And if you look at a number of our stocks that have done very well for us over the last few years, they've had a tricky start to 22, but now look, very attractive value compared to long-term averages given that fall off. And for us, because I think, fundamentally, we believe those companies will deliver great long-term returns, it's a good opportunity for us to top up in those situations.
Mm. Whenever you have these kind of seismic events, people, it makes sense to, I suppose, kind of really kick the tires in your investment thesis and see if anything's changed. One of your kind of bigger holdings in the investment trust is Impax Asset Management. And I suppose there's kind of an interesting discussion around the nature of ESG. There's this argument that perhaps the current crisis has really highlighted the kind of energy dependency areas like Europe have on Russia, and perhaps arguably it could trigger a further boost for kind of renewables. And then, I don't know, maybe it kind of again kind of shifts how people see ESG. Are in situations like this, are defence companies kind of something you can be a bit more favourable on? I mean, have you considered this kind of in the context of impacts, and what are your views there?
Let's take this in various stages. So in terms of how we approach ESG as our perspective, we're not an ESG fund. We don't have exclusion lists. But however, because we're a very significant investor in the UK mid and small cap space, typically a top 10 investor, we're engaging with our businesses all the time. We did ESG before ESG was even coined the phrase. And we do think ESG is an important aspect to investment perspective. We do think that companies need to act in the right way from environmental, social and governance perspective. And we're all about the journey in that, in context of that improvement. I think ESG is a structural shift in the way investors are approaching their portfolios. I don't think that's going away. And we own more than defence companies. I mean, that's, it's all about whether they can actually, they're on the journey in terms of improving it. So I think we think it's an important thing. We do engage with our corporates on a very regular basis. So I do think ESG is a structural long-term trend. I think we can see that from how clients have reacted over the last couple of years and how that's become an increasingly important perspective from their own investment portfolios. Impacts as a stock, I mean, it's our top holding at the end of the year. It's been a great performer for us in the last, we've owned it for about 5 years now. It's done phenomenally well. Clearly, as a specialist ESG investor, it's been very successful. It's grown its AUM very significantly. It doubled AUM last year, for example, and with significant flows. As a long-term investor in ESG stocks, it's got the expertise and skills and track record. That means it's been certainly growing very well. So we think the long-term outlook for impacts is undiminished and very strong indeed. We'll continue to grow over the medium term, and as aspirations to double again from this AUM over the next few years. It's had a tricky start to 22, as a lot of is referred to already around the kind of the evaluation of growth into value stocks. It's fallen by over 30% year to date, but nothing's really changed. Fund flows in January were very strong. I mean, there's been a mark to market impact because there are investor in equities and equities have fallen, so there might be some impact from that. But the underlying strength of the business is still there, and I think it is an inexorable trend in terms of how we all approach ESG, and I think they'll continue to win AUM. So we've not lost any faith in impacts as a position. If anything, it's a great long-term buying opportunity.
There is an interesting argument on the ESG front that some of the, what you might call a stalwart, so some of those names like impacts that have a long heritage of being focused on ESG, perhaps you wouldn't really accuse them of, being part of the greenwashing trend. But there is an argument that they are at risk of, I suppose, like any market leaders, perhaps kind of being less nimble and not being as quick to adapt to changes in things like ESG investing than perhaps some of the kind of newer upstarts. I mean, how would you take on that? Is that something that you're kind of conscious of?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's obviously we got to look at the fundamentals of the business and whether it continued to grow as it has done previously. And as you said, it's going to be clearly because any market that's in growth will attract competition. So you look at its kind of its moat, its barrier to entry, its competitive advantages. And You know, I think the, you know, when a large US pension or teachers pension fund is collecting someone, you know, they're going to look at, you know, the quality of the performance track record, the quality of the people, the kind of the quality of the process, and fundamentally impacts will score very highly. And I'm not going to win everything, but I still think, you know, they will win most of the time compared to some of the newer peers who haven't got that track record. So as long as they remain, you know, stick to their knitting and do what they've done previously and keep, you know, retain the quality of the staff and recruit well, and don't lose the kind of the discipline and focus they've got, then I think they should continue to be a successor in that area.
Yeah, makes sense. To stick with some of your kind of bigger holdings, you do hold some other names that are likely popular with many of our listeners. So, for example, Future and, you know, Watches of Switzerland, they could be viewed as sort of darlings of recent time periods. But again, they've, you know, run into trickier times. How are you kind of feeling on those two names?
Look, a similar story to Impacts. I mean, both have been, you know, we've owned Watches since it's IPO'd. So that's been not 2 or 3 years now it's IPO'd. Future we've owned for 5 or 6 years. I mean, and we are very long term in our approach. So the average holding period of stocks of portfolio is well over 6 years, and there's a lot of investments we've owned for much longer than that. So, you know, we don't invest for a kind of short-term return. This is very much a long-term approach. And to be honest, again, I mean, both share prices, you know, after what a very, very strong 21s have performed quite poorly in 22 so far. Again, it's all back to that point about derating of growth companies and the rotation away from growth into value. But actually operationally, both have continued to perform exceptionally well. Watch the Switzerland had, you know, very strong growth last year. A number of upgrades went through the course of the year. The outlook remains very strong. Demand for Rolex watches has not diminished at all. The waiting list is still as long as anyone's arm. And the expansion plans in the US and Europe are, you know, extremely kind of credible. So the long-term growth rates should remain very good. Future, again, I mean, they delivered upgrade after upgrade during 21. It's an incredibly impressive management team run by Zillabin Thorne. You know, the positioning regarding digital advertising, digital commerce, again, remains extremely strong. They've got a very successful track record of doing M&A and strategic M&A, which has enhanced returns for shareholders. And, you know, I think, you know, it's a feature, you know, in this market is that you've seen a bit of profit taking this year. There's been a lot of gains people are sitting on this one. It's as like Impacts and Watches derated significantly. So typically Futures traded on well north of 20 times prospective earnings. It's now, you know, you look at the numbers down to around 15 times. I mean, that is a kind of a bargain in context of historical rating numbers. So we're as committed to those holdings as we ever have been. So yeah, look, I think that is the opportunity. You know, for us, it's about picking the right stocks. And as long as operationally they continue to perform well and deliver the growth we think they should deliver, then fundamentally the share price will take care of itself over time.
So as you've said, you're kind of a growth investor, I suppose, interested in kind of structural growth stories. And I imagine perhaps like many fund managers, you may say, you know, I'm bottom up macro, you know, that's not really my business. I don't worry about macro. It's not what I'm paid to do. But what strikes me about this year and perhaps the back end of last year is it does really feel much more influenced by macro events so far, at least. Does that have any kind of knock-on effect? I mean, you mentioned kind of the growth at the right price approach. I mean, does the right price change? Do you want more of kind of a discount in, you know, in to compensate for the greater uncertainty? And is there anything you kind of have to be more aware of than you would be in perhaps slightly more peaceful times?
I would argue it's been macro for more than just in the last year. And this year's been actually, I mean, I would argue throughout the course of 21, I think macro was a driving factor of markets over that period of time. And definitely this year, it's been very much macro rather than micro. I think macro in the short term, micro in the long term. You know, again, I come back to that point, you know, fundamentally, if you are buying the right companies and your investment thesis plays out as you expect it to do, and they deliver the growth, and the macro will sort itself out. And we have to kind of try and avoid that noise, because if we basically try to flex a portfolio for macro noise, we'd be changing the portfolio six times a year. Which we don't do. You know, we are, you know, we haven't got that flexibility and luxury in small cap. There's liquidity is always a feature. We're running a reasonable amount of money in the space. We have to take a long-term approach. And you always want to pay the right price for the companies you're buying, and you want to ensure that the growth is more than justifies the valuation you're paying for it. But that's just part of the job we do. But I think, you know, we're not going to shift the process or the portfolio materially if growth suddenly out of favor for a couple of months, because it can go back into favor in a couple of months' time. I just do think the micro potentially wins out over the longer term.
And as you mentioned, we've already seen many of those shifts last year. It's quite a topsy-turvy 2021. But you mentioned kind of sticking to the process, and I suppose, like some other kind of smaller companies, funds, you've been quite keen on running your winners. What now, say in the trust, what is the kind of balance of mid caps to small caps?
So yeah, that is that point about, you know, running a winner. So we don't. So if you think about the new investments, we don't buy anything in the new investments unless they're within our size band. So we use the Numis index as our benchmark. So anything below about 1.5 billion market cap is already in our investment sphere. So any new investments in there, but if they do well and they seem to grow beyond it and successful, we will continue to own them. The point where we are forced sell it against the FTSE 100. So exactly two examples recently, Dechra Pharmaceuticals and I think Howden both, you know, joined the FTSE, and we had to sell them over the next 6 months. But that's a good discipline to have. That's one of the reasons why we have quite a mid-cap bias to our portfolio, that run the winners approach. So if you look at the shape of the portfolio, it's around 60% mid-cap, around 15% small cap, and 25% AIM. And you know, that, why do we have that mix? Well, I think that's one of the winners approach. So if you're buying things when they're small and they're doing well and growing and being successful, naturally you should hope to move into 250 over time and get bigger. And if you're owning good companies that do well, they should make that grade. But also it's around liquidity. You know, fundamentally, again, the portfolio is, so, you know, reason why large money we're running in the space, and therefore we're naturally going to gravitate towards the largest small caps and mid caps because they have the liquidity for us to invest in them. I mean, this is not a micro cap product. We really haven't got the ability or liquidity to invest in, you know, companies below 150 million market cap. It's just what we can't look at. So we gravitate towards larger small cap and mid cap. But fundamentally, we're pretty index, we're index aware, but we don't really care where it comes from. It's a good idea. It's a good idea. Mid cap, small cap, or AIM, and the portfolio drives itself in that context.
Yeah, I mean, does that tell us something about the kind of investment universe? I mean, when you're looking for your potential winners, are you simply finding that some of these established names that have now drifted into mid-cap territory are kind of harder to assail if you're kind of one of those plucky upstarts? Or, you know, what are those two opportunity sets like?
So we're not particularly, you know, focused on where it comes from. And obviously, as long as it's got enough liquidity for us to invest in, we're pretty, keen to look across the whole market, whether it's AIM, small cap, or mid cap. And, you know, best returns we get from are investing in, you know, smaller companies that can grow into larger companies over a period of time. And some of those companies you mentioned already, I mean, I think where Future started, or, you know, where Impact started, I mean, you know, they started at, you know, a fraction of where they are today in context of market cap size. They're the best returns we can drive. It's finding those undiscovered gems that will, you know, essentially multiply many times over the course of a decade or shorter. Our opportunity set doesn't really change over time. We are very much, you know, open to anything within the context of our investment sphere.
And say you are kind of fishing on those, I suppose, further down the market cap scale, or relatively as far down as you can go. What, at the minute, what kind of themes are you finding most appealing? You know, what's really standing out to you as a kind of potential kind of driver of returns?
So today, I mean, I think that, well, we'll make the point that, you know, we don't really like blue sky or loss-making businesses. Fundamentally, we like profitable cash generative particularly, and probably dividend-paying businesses. So we're not really going to be invested in sort of blue sky loss-making things. More established companies we're looking to buy into. I often tend to find the market overvalues those blue sky, or doesn't, you know, account for all the various risks they may have. If I think about where the opportunity set is today, to be honest, we're not really adding new names at this point. I think we've added one new name this year so far. There is enough value in our current portfolio in things that we know and like and understand and have met multiple times. So we really, at the moment, the opportunity is for us to top up a lot of those situations that we already have, where we think there's been the share prices at falls have been overdone.
And you mentioned that in terms of selling or kind of no longer running your winners, that would happen when something enters the FTSE 100. But of course, there will be instances where you have to sell for perhaps less fruitful reasons.
Yeah.
What has generally triggered you to kind of call time in a stock and think this, this isn't appealing anymore?
No, I think there's, I think, fund managers are kind of, it's sort of 80-20, 70-30 game, isn't it, really? Let's be honest here, we don't get everything right. Fundamentally, I'd love to believe that we are, infallible. We're not, and we do make mistakes. We try to minimise those and get more right than wrong. What makes us sell? Well, obviously, a number of reasons. We talked about, obviously, when it gets to FTSE 100, that happens on a rare occasion. We obviously get bids, quite a few bids. M&A activity in the portfolio is quite active, so those can naturally fall out. But also things where our investment thesis change or where things don't work out as we expected to do. What are the trigger points for that? It's clearly around the kind of the reverse of our buy decisions. So we talk about the four M's in terms of our, the things we look for in the companies we invest in, and those are model. This model, economic franchise, competitive advantage, Porter's five forces, SWOT analysis of the business, management, incredibly important in small cap, often driven led by one or two key individuals, assess the strategy, motivation, vision, corporate governance, alignment with shareholders. We meet companies on a very regular basis, getting their management teams pretty well over a long period of time. Money, so balance sheet and cash flow. So the team is all accountants by training. Apologize for that, but it's so we hopefully can analyze the P&L on a balance sheet and cash flow. And then momentum's around earnings momentum. So finding companies that will over deliver against market expectations, provide the upgrades that we'd expect from our portfolio companies. The trigger, for selling is the reverse of those. So things that change in our four M's. So new competitor, a lack of pricing power, change in management team, deteriorating financials in context of balance sheet and cash flow, poor earnings momentum or a profit warning are all kind of red flags to us, which may or may not prompt to sell the business. And also valuation. So, we GARP, we're growth at the right price. So valuation is important to us. And if thing becomes too expensive, then we should be selling it. We're not kind of, we don't hold at all costs. A GARP portfolio should have the right valuation attached to it. If anything, the kind of the 2000 tech crisis or tech bubble taught us is that, you've got to pay the right price for the companies you buy, and growth at any price is not acceptable.
This is probably a slippery slope, but, in recent years, now and then, you've heard some fund managers talking about perhaps how they've had to become a little bit more relaxed about kind of valuations, I suppose, both in terms of where you buy and perhaps, where you have to sell when it comes to these kind of quality and growth stocks. It sounds like the answer is probably no, but I mean, is that something that's kind of applied to your process at all?
I mean, valuation is a kind of both an absolute and a relative measure, isn't it? So you have to look at it in context of the overall market and where it stands in that basis, but also absolute and compared to history. So yeah, it is, again, an art rather than science evaluation. We don't really like selling great companies. We tend to trim more than completely sell out of things where we think they've reached fair value. The GARP nature of the portfolio means we do think value is important, and then we have to pay the right price for it. So yeah, I wouldn't say we've become, sort of just ignored valuation. And we do have to a nod towards that. But it does depend on market levels and relative and absolute levels.
Mm. And you mentioned before the M&A activity, that, and I suppose the IPOs last year, we really saw extremely high levels of activity. I'd imagine, have you seen that kind of dropping off quite sharply so far this year? Does that have a big kind of impact on your portfolios?
So two sides of the equation there. I think, so let's start with IPOs. IPOs was a really busy 2021, and that's after a pretty fallow 2020 for obvious reasons, because the market was in a state of flux with COVID and didn't know where we're going to be next week, rather than next year. So it was clearly obviously a year when things, a lot of things didn't happen. Therefore, a big backlog in 2021, and we were pretty active in IPOs in 2021. know, the great thing about working at Janus Henderson is we're a big investor in the space across things. We're a desired shareholder, so we get great access. So we typically meet these IPOs, you know, 7-8 months before they even come to market with early looks, deep dive meetings with management teams well below the top executive level. We'll get great access up to IPO. So we know them pretty well. And to be honest, we kiss a lot of frogs. Last year we did a lot of meetings, a lot of pre-IPO meetings, early looks, fair amount of rubbish we saw as well that never saw light of day or we didn't invest in. I think we did 7 IPOs in total. And for us, actually, they are great long-term opportunities for us to invest in quality businesses. And you already talked about, for example, Watches, for example, was an IPO 3 years ago and been a phenomenal performer for us. So you can pick those stocks. That's really very good. So we're pretty active in the IPO space, and you know, it's a good opportunity, a rich source of new opportunity. 22 looks really quiet. I mean, it's obviously, you know, the event so far from a macro perspective with quantitative tightening and interest rates, but now geopolitical events means that, you know, the IPO market is essentially dead, and I think will remain incredibly quiet throughout Q2, and Q3 is typically quiet because it's summer months and no one's really here. So I don't think the IPO market really, if anything, comes back to Q4. So that's fine. I mean, there'll be a lot in 23 probably. So I mean, it's not as if we aren't short of opportunity in the market overall. M&A, other side of the coin. Following 2020, we had 8 companies in our portfolio acquired in 21. Sorry, get my years right. And you look at who's buying UK corporates, and it's essentially overseas and private equity. And the UK market, and I'm sure you've had this banged into a number of times, the UK market's cheap, particularly compared to international markets. It's really underperformed ever since 2016, and it looks very cheap. And I think overseas corporates and private equity sense that opportunity in terms of value. So we're seeing a lot of inward M&A into the UK equity market. And of the 8 companies in our portfolio that were acquired in 21, 6 were from private equity and 2 foreign corporates. So to be honest, I think going to 22, that continues. I think the equity market falls we've seen so far this year, particularly in small and mid-cap, which has underperformed the FTSE, means a lot of value out there for these buyers. And there's a real discrepancy between public market transactions and private market transactions in terms of private public market valuations and private transactions. So you look at, for example, this year, you didn't own it, but John Menges has bought an 80% premium. We've had a bid yesterday for one of our top 10 Oxford Instruments from Spectris at a 50% premium. We've seen transactions in the private market. So Informa selling its B2B division for over 30 times EBITDA, which is a massive multiple to previous to comparable companies in the market. And also we saw an early look company last year, an IPO, which we're really interested in, was bought by another private company at 25 times EBITDA. Again, probably much higher than we'd have paid for it. So I think there's a real gap between public and private, and I think that will lead to more M&A. So I think it could be quite, although geopolitics are clearly quite front and center currently, I do think M&A continues to be a big theme for small mid-cap in 22.
That must be quite a bittersweet experience, I suppose, kind of seeing those bids come in. Because on the one hand, you know, nice uplift for your portfolio. On the other hand, as we've discussed, you like to run winners and you simply can't do that anymore. How do you feel?
So it is a bittersweet experience because exactly, you kind of, let's take Austin Smith as an example. We've owned that for, a long period of time. It must be well over 10 years. We think the prospects of business are extremely good longer term. It's in all the right areas. I mean, sort of semiconductors, advanced materials, quantum computing. It's growing its top line by double digit. It's margin improvement. The margin improvements coming through. Net cash balance sheet, strong management team. Tick, 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 tick. I mean, so yeah, we like it. It's top, number 4 holding. However, you know, if someone's willing to pay tomorrow's price or, 3 years' time's price today, then, fundamentally we can cash on and move on. Because, I mean, there's a lot of opportunity in the SMID space to buy other quality companies. So, yeah, it's a bittersweet moment, but you can't fall in love with companies you own. You are ultimately running a portfolio of investments to maximize shareholder returns. And therefore, if an opportunity comes along to maximize that value and move on, then so be it.
Need to be emotionally unattached, I suppose.
Yeah, it's a good way of looking at it.
And finally, I just wanted to touch on, you're focusing on individual companies, but your sector allocations are quite interesting. I mean, you know, like you say, you have a growth focus and the portfolio is going to get buffeted about in sort of current conditions. But perhaps there's a glimmer of hope in, at least from a kind of a brief glance at your allocations. You know, you have some financials in there, you have some industrials, perhaps also, you know, your consumer discretionary weighting could help with things like pricing power in inflationary times. How are you feeling on kind of different sectors right now? I mean, are there particular industries that you're thinking, oh, there are some interesting, you know, macro, non-macro caveats aside, you know, are there interesting tailwinds that are kind of making you look more closely in certain areas?
I think I make the point that we're not sector focused. We are very much bottom up stock driven. So that can the sector business come out of stocks? But fundamentally, given the GARP style, we're going to be naturally more gravitate towards those areas that are intrinsically growth areas, and underweight those are more value based areas. So you're going to find our portfolio being heavy in electronics, pharmaceuticals, software, industrials. We're going to be underweight real estate, food producers, mining, oil and gas, because that's a natural consequence of where we look for in the portfolio. Fundamentally, given the nature of the process, that's going to remain the way going forward. So, I think the focus on the individual stocks is much more important to us than the sector position. But we are naturally going to have a bias within the context of our portfolio overall.
How are you feeling about the industrials names that you hold? Because you have a fair allocation there, and I suppose perhaps surprisingly, in the industrial sector as a whole seems to have struggled as well this year. Perhaps you could assume that it would actually do better than it has done.
Look, I think that I think we've historically had a weighting towards industrials, and for example, where Oxford's one of the key holdings we've had in the space. There's not a problem with the top line on the industrial sector currently. Demand globally is very strong as we come out of COVID. Markets recover very strong. There's a requirement for CapEx catch up. And even the move towards green technologies is driving a lot of CapEx around that. So there's globally industrial production is strong and likely to remain so. And I think a look at the companies that I own and their order books look very, very strong into 2022. The problem's been around supply chain and delivering that. So you've had the issues around particularly component shortages. Semiconductors have been an issue for a lot of industries, particularly automotive, for example, been very high profile, but generally electronics and semis have been hard to get hold of. But also it's been into other raw materials. There's been supply chain challenges. Logistics have been an issue. I mean, the price of container shipping from China's escalated massively over the course of the last year, and naturally it's been, again, costs have gone up across the board, and also people as well. I mean, obviously wage inflation is coming back a bit, and there's been the great resignation and employee turnover has picked up. So it's really been deliverance. The top line has been absolutely fine, or the growth, the order book has been absolutely fine, but it's the cost of delivering that. So there've been a bit of issues around that. That resolves itself. Fundamentally, these things will fade over time. And the quality and strength of demand overall and the length of order book these companies have will translate into increased profitability in 2022 and 2023. So we're pretty optimistic about that space overall into the coming year.
And again, the macro sort of leaking into our conversation, but have you found yourself kind of sitting strongly in either the transitory or non-transitory camp? I mean, do you feel quite relaxed about these inflationary pressures?
It's above my pay grade. So look, I'm not going to try and sit here and tell you I know all of what's going to happen on a macro perspective, and I think we hear different arguments about transitory and non-transitory inflation. The base effect clearly kicks through, so clearly we're going to start to peak inflation, and particularly in UK in April with the energy prices more cap coming off on electricity and gas prices, should fade over time. And I think, for example, we are seeing supply chain on the whole not getting worse, the margin getting a bit better. I think from our perspective is that it's what we're trying to focus on, ensuring the companies we own have pricing power. So if inflation is going to be more stubborn than some observers expect, then can companies recover that through prices? Do they have the right products? The consumers will accept, or the consumer of their product accept price rises? Do they have IP, some degree of differentiation that means they can pass those through. So what you don't want in an inflation environment is companies no pricing power. So again, quality, you know, companies with, you know, high degree of levels of IP and differentiation are things to own.
Yeah, yeah. Perhaps a red flag to look for then, the pricing power weakness. Okay, I think that's a really interesting point on which to wrap up then. I'm afraid that's all we have time for, but many thanks to Neil for joining me, and many thanks to everyone for listening. Take care.
Hey, folks, I'm Mark Maron from the WTF podcast, and this episode is brought to you by Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues, your ally to help tackle your allergy symptoms this season. I love the change of seasons, but nobody loves pollen and all those other things floating in the air that make you sneeze during this nice weather. Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues are hypoallergenic and allergist approved. So fight back against watery eyes and runny noses without worrying about irritating your skin. For this allergy season, grab Kleenex and face allergies head on.